This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This show, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. And I'm delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest, trainer Shane Myers. At this taping, Shane has won 134 races, most of them in the last 3 years. His stable is enjoying their best year ever, and he's already won 36 races and 189 starts in 2016, and certainly more victories are on the horizon. Welcome to the show, Shane.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jude. It's always a pleasure.
Let's start at the beginning, like we usually do here on the Trainer Talk. Like many of the trainers featured on this program, you were born into the thoroughbred racing game. What was it like to have popular Ohio jockey Tommy Myers for a dad?
Well, you know, when I was going to the track, I was young at the beginning, so I really had no idea what was going on. But, you know, as I got older, you know, it was pretty cool to, you know, realize how important and everything he'd done, you know, see all the work that he put into it. And you know how it is. I mean, it's just it's an interesting thing, you know, looking at it from being the son of a jockey and then seeing it all come together, you know, like all the stuff that goes into the races. So
he won 2,414 races in his career, which is quite an accomplishment. Did he used to take you to the track in the mornings, or did you just a weekend excursion? How'd that work?
Yeah, he didn't take me very often. He didn't really want me to be involved in racing. So maybe on the weekends, like over the summer, I'd get to go. You know, I always wanted to go, but he wouldn't let me go very often in the morning. So there was nothing I could do, though. You know, when you're 7 or 8, you can't get there on your own. So.
I know that feeling, that's for sure. I always used to want to go to the races with my dad. And, you know, he had 4 sons, so he would alternate, you know, and it used to kill me when I wasn't going. Once in a while, my brother Paul would give up his spot and I would take it. But, it's tough when you're a little guy and you're into it. When did you know that racing was for you? I mean, that you really enjoyed the sport?
When I started learning more about the handicapping aspect of it, like probably when I was, you know, 11 or 12, and I started to like look at the racing form and I started to learn, you know, the different things in there. You know, obviously what was in it then and what's in it now are, you know, you're looking at two different pieces of paper with all the information, but it just started to fascinate me and everything with the handicapping side of it, you know, because I didn't know a whole lot about the actual horse at that time. So the handicapping was the first thing, but I'd say probably like when I was 11 or 12.
When you were 11 or 12, you started handicapping in earnest, so to speak?
I don't know if you want to say in earnest. I mean, I was probably betting $2 to win and show, you know, so.
Were you one of those kids that ran around the grandstand trying to get somebody to get you down on a horse?
Well, my grandpa was always there, so I didn't have to. He just put the bets in for me. But, you know, when you're that age and, you know, you have $18, $20, that's kind of a lot of money, you know, back in our day. So, I mean, 2 to win and show is a big thing, you know, especially when you're betting a 3 to 1 or something and it wins and you get like, you know, 8 to win and 340 to show, you're pretty happy. So
yeah, it looks like a fortune.
Yeah.
Your grandfather, was he involved in racing as well?
He owned horses, but he like did a little bit of stuff on the backside, but not much.
Was that your father's father or your mother's father?
No, that was my mom's dad, and that's how they met at the track. So, you know, from always being there.
Are you on some kind of a seagoing venture?
On what?
A seagoing venture. I hear like a horn in the background. Are you in Cleveland?
Yeah, it's my phone. I'm getting a bunch of texts. So you know how that is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, trainer's always busy on the phone. So your mom, she's always been very supportive of you. Did she take a different view of you being on the racetrack than your father did?
I think they kind of worked together on it. I mean, I just don't think that they wanted me to be on the backside and all that stuff when, you know, when I was younger. You know, I think they wanted me to, you know, try to go to college and, you know, become more successful than most of the people at the racetrack up here. So I never really asked them why they didn't let me. So
did you end up going to school?
Yeah, I graduated in, I don't know what year it was, maybe 2000 at Kent State. And then right after that, I pretty much started, you know, to get more interested in the horses. You know, I was always involved in it, but I started to become more interested in the actual horse rather than just the handicapping side.
Yeah, so how did you start getting your experience as, you know, as a horseman?
The first thing I really, I claimed a few horses and just owned them, and my uncle trained them, and, you know, after a few years of that, I said, well, you know, there's really absolutely no reason why I can't do this, and I started to go to Tampa in the winter and just, you know, learn what I could, which wasn't, you know, a super lot, but, you know, you learn what you can while you're helping other people, but once you get on your own and you actually have horses of your own and you see every single thing that goes into it, you know, you realize how much you don't really know until, you know, the first few years that you get under your belt. So you just start picking up knowledge, you know, that you never even thought about because the trainer was doing everything and you were just, you know, helping them. So,
yeah, there's a lot of different facets to being a trainer. And you're right. I think until your name's on the program and you actually, you know, are responsible for the horse 100%, it's a little bit different dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's much different.
Do you have any people in particular that helped you along the way to help you understand the training game?
John Gachardo was instrumental in helping me. My uncle helped me, Bart Barnes, and Mike Deeney helped me. And, you know, from being around them all the time, you know, you pick up, you know, small things of what they do and, you know, things that you think that they do that are good and, you know, or maybe things that they do that you don't think are so good. And, you know, you try to alter it and come up with your own, you know, finishing touches on, you know, what they do, and hopefully you can get lucky and win a race. So, but, you know, obviously I'm just still learning now. You know, you got to get lucky to win a horse race. So, you know how that is, Jude.
Yeah, wherever you run, it's not easy. And, you know, we take it for granted sometimes that, you know, trainers or that have nice horses and win races, that it's easy for them, and it's never easy. I mean, from the Todd Pletchers of the world to people that are training at little fair tracks all over the country during the summertime, it's pretty tough to win a race anywhere. And that's why my friend Shay Knight used to say you should be able to rent the winner circle, because we work so hard. You might take a year to get a horse ready for a race, and the horse wins, and you're in the winner's circle for like 30 seconds. And she always said you should be able to rent it and have a party. I think that's true. It's very hard. A lot of things to overcome. It's important, I think, too. I'd like to get your take on it. working with and for different people, you mentioned not having not doing something that you saw them do that you didn't think worked. And that comparison between trainers, I think it's important now for younger trainers to work for several different people so they have that comparison.
Oh, yeah. I mean, certain things just, you know, obviously they may, I think a lot of people, you know, do things or have done things in the past because it was maybe more convenient to their time schedule of, you know, their day or what was going on. And, you know, to me, I try to do things more for what I think benefits the horse. You know, I know a lot of people feed their horses at, you know, 11 o'clock and then they give them their dinner, you know, at 3:30, 4 o'clock, and then they don't, you know, some people don't feed three times a day. You know, I do, but you know, I try to space my feedings out over the course of the day, you know, because I think it's just better for the horses. And, you know, but, you know, when you're working for people and you're like, man, how could this guy feed at 11 and 3:30 and then the horse doesn't get any more food until the following day, it's, you know, you just start thinking about things like that when you're at home, not at the track, you know, that it's not great for the horse, you know. But obviously when you're doing a job for someone else, you do it the way that they want you to do it, not the way that you're supposed, that you want to do it. You do what they want. So that was one of the main things that I, like, always thought was the way people fed horses. So.
Yeah, talk about that and you know, why you think it's important to feed three times a day. I know there's some guys that feed two, some guys that feed four. What's the philosophy and why do you think it's better for the horse?
Well, I think just get more meals, you know, for the horse probably. You know, obviously every horse is different, and I think that's one of the, you know, main things. But if you go back, you know, and we water at 9 o'clock and they have eaten all their grain, which most of them have, you know, we'll give them another half a scoop of food, you know, just to, you know, so they're not hungry. And I just think the more small meals is better for their systems, you know, to get things going through them and make sure the horse can be as healthy as possible. So,
yeah, in today's day and age with, you know, ulcers and that kind of thing being part of, you know, horsemanship and care of horses, it does make sense. I know Bobby Frankel, he used to have his night watchman throw a can of oats into the horses' feed tubs if they'd eaten up, you know, that they got something early in the morning, like even before the grooms got there. And it certainly worked for him. So I think you're right. I think a lot of times, you know, racing's a tough game, and we all know it's 7 days a week. But you're right. People try to make it easy on themselves, and they don't put their horses first. And that's one of the benefits, I think, of being a small trainer and a hands-on guy like yourself, that you can tailor-make the program to each horse. It's not like you have a system because you're training 300 horses.
Oh, it's a huge advantage. The people who have that many horses, I know they're doing well, and it's great to have that many horses, but I don't envy them for, you know, a second with all the work and everything they have to put into it. And, you know, I know how tough it must be. That's why when you see a guy who has this many starts and all these wins, you know, you just have to shake your head in amazement, you know, that how they're really doing a great job with everything they're doing.
Yeah, because in the end, it's kind of a numbers game for those guys. They have a lot of horses and they win a lot of races, but the horses are probably, you know, not getting the attention of the primary trainer. They all have very good assistants, but it's still not like having your horse with a trainer that's really paying attention every day to those particular horses and the things that you see and that type of stuff when horses are training, because these trainers aren't even seeing all their horses every day.
Oh, yeah, for me, I know that's the truth. You know, you have to have unbelievably good help and reliable people, you know, who are going to do things, because obviously, you know, you're not going to be able to be there when you're running at different tracks. You can't be there, you know, 24/7, so you have to have good people, and I'm sure, you know, that's probably why every once in a while you'll see a horse claimed from one of those bigger barns that ends up doing good, just because, you know, who knows who's taking care of it. You know, they probably have a lot of employment changes, and, you know, who knows who's there. And, you know, I don't care what anyone says. When you're not there yourself, it's not going to get done as good as when you are. So,
yeah, it's important to get to the barn early before your help is beneficial, and make sure everything is run the way that you wanted it to be run. In case anybody's tuned in late, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Shane Myers on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. When you get to the barn in the morning, what's your routine?
You know, normally we get all the cold walkers out and all the basic stuff, you know, take the horse's temperature, make sure they jog sound before they go to the track. And if there's an issue, you know, walk them and make sure they've cleaned their tubs and, you know, just the basic stuff and, you know, just go on and get ready for the races if we have anything in, and just go through the basics as, you know, most people I'm sure do.
Yeah. Do you, what's your work schedule like? Do you tailor make that? Are you a 5-day work guy, 6-day, 7-day? How does that work?
Myself?
Yeah.
Oh, I pretty much work 7 days. Just if I could get lucky and get a day off, that would be great. But, you know, having horses, you know, at 3 different racetracks right now, it's hard to always get a day off. But, you know, I have unbelievable help at Belterra and Presque Isle. So, and I only have 5 horses at Presque Isle. So the guys up there, you know, I don't even really need to mess with them. They've worked for me for 2 years. They know what's going on. And the guys who are at Belterra and Cincinnati, I mean, they're, things run like I'm there, even if I'm not. So it's 7 days a week and a lot of driving, but I'd ideally like to be just at one location, you know, because it's a lot easier to do everything when you're there and you have the team all together and everyone gets along. But it didn't work out that way this year because it was my first year going somewhere else aside from just being in Cleveland. So, but right now I'm working 7 days a week, but I don't think that ever changes, does it, Jude?
No, it's definitely a 7-day a week job. I mean, some guys now, you were talking about the convenience factor. They actually schedule a day off every week, like Tuesdays when they're not running. And I mean, I think that's cool in a way, but I don't think I could do that. I wouldn't want to be away from the horses. You know, I liked the everyday thing. Cause you want to see your horses, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously if you don't see your horses, you don't know as well as going on with them as if you did, you know. So that's the one thing that you need to have good help, you know, like to tell you what's going on because you obviously can only be in one place at one time. So, but the team always, you know, communicates well and, you know, you make plans and if you need to go somewhere, then you have to go.
How many miles do you log on your car every month?
I don't even pay attention, Jude.
You need to because you can deduct that on your income tax.
Oh, I don't know. Probably 5,000-6,000 a month. I don't know.
Wow. That's crazy. You go back and forth how many times a week?
I normally go to Presque Isle maybe once a week. And, like, if I have something in, and I'll go to Belterra once or twice a week, just depending on the way things are with the entries because – some of the people at Thistledown, you know, they need, they want me to be there, and that's where most of my horses are. So the owners want you to be there, so I'll have to be there if I have a horse in and stuff. So, which is no big deal, you know, because the schedules are, they work pretty well together with the schedules of Thistledown and Belterra. You know, they pretty much run different schedules. The only day they don't run is Tuesday, so... Belterra is Thursday through Sunday and Thistle's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. So I just normally go where, you know, it makes sense to be.
Right. Well, it's a lot different training horses in the Midwest and the East Coast than it is in California, where I trained, because California's like an island. I mean, you go from one racetrack to the other and you're still relatively close in area, but when you're training in the Midwest and the East Coast, there's so many racetracks and there's races available everywhere. And you see trainers walking around with the stacks of condition books, or nowadays a lot of guys have all the condition books on their iPad, and so they can find the proper spots. How much time do you spend with the condition books?
An unbelievable amount. I mean, it's, you know, the problem is with all the options, a lot of races don't fill, so you're always looking to try to find spots for your horses, you know, where they can be competitive. And, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work out where a race doesn't go, and there's, you know, you waited for that race, and the race that you could have went in, you entered 2 days before, so you have to make a plan. And then, you know, you don't want to run in a spot that you're going to be 30-1, so you have to always be looking and, you know, seeing what's available, you know. And with all the options, you know, you're on Equibase looking at places you never thought you were going to run this year just because the race didn't go. And it, you know how it is. I mean, I wish it was as easy as it was in California where you just had like the two options. But here, you know, you just don't know with the shortage of horses across the country. You don't know what is going to fill and what isn't. And so you have to look for other places to run.
Yeah, it's a common complaint here on Trainer Talk that, you know, with the way that racing is now and the way some of these tracks handle their condition book, they'll have, you know, 10 races in the book, and then they'll have another 5 or 6 extras in the book, and then they'll put 10 more on the overnight, and it's almost impossible to train a horse up to a specific race. Do you find it that way?
Oh, it's terrible because, you know, I've gotten to the point where, you know, sometimes you want to run in a certain race that you know is coming up in 5 days, but you see another race that comes up on the extras that, you know, you've been pointing for the race that's 5 days later, but you just have, you know, you sometimes are like, hey, if that race is going, you know, maybe you should go. And, you know, I wish they would, you know, come up with a new policy more in the Midwest for, you know, where you could scratch if the other race was going to go without getting penalized. But, you know, the scratch rules at some of the places are, you know, insane. Like you get 14 days if you scratch a horse at Presque Isle, you know, if you get a vet scratch, and, you know, when you're getting 14 days, you know, that's 2 weeks gone that you can't run. But, you know, if you get in a spot where you're going to be 20-1, you know, you don't really want to run. So it's terrible. You know, I wish they would do the books how they do at the tracks that fill their races and just make people run where there was a race, you know, instead of giving 20 options to, you know, make 8 races, give 11 or 12 options to make 8 races. It'd be a lot better for everyone. So, but it is hard to, you know, rely on a certain race unless you know it's like a maiden race that's going to go for sure, or, you know. But the other races that are, you know, you're hoping get 6 or 7 horses and hope they fill and they don't, it's terrible because you've just put all this time into a horse that you didn't even get to run. So it's awful.
Yeah.
But I don't know what they can do to change it.
Well, I think sometimes there's such a jealousy between racetracks for horses. And, you know, there was a situation where at Monmouth Park where they were, you know, telling people they weren't going to let them back in if they went and raced other racetracks. And I mean, things like that, they're counterproductive for the game. And we really need to figure it out. And it's not just the smaller tracks. It's the larger tracks too. I mean, you go to Gulfstream Park and there's like 20 races available, and they've killed 2 or 3 book races with extras. And you know, the trainers are very frustrated by that. It's a hard enough game when everything's, you know, laid out and the book goes every day. But when you have to like be juggling, and then you work a horse and all of a sudden they pop a race up the next day, well, what are you supposed to do? It's insane.
Yeah, well, the book should be Bible in my opinion, but that's why I'm not a racing secretary. But it's terrible when a book race gets 7 or 8 horses and then they use an extra that's got 7 horses or 6 horses in it. But, you know, I know the racing secretaries have a tough job, so I don't normally get real involved in it, and I just take it and move on. So
Yeah, as the great trainer Arnold Winnick said, don't say anything unless it's going to benefit you.
Yeah.
So picking a fight with a racing secretary isn't usually a good move. You know, that's something for each trainer to decide for themselves, but I know it can be frustrating. You mentioned a couple times about entering your horse in a race, and you see the horse is 20-1 on the morning line or whatever, and forgetting that a lot of morning line makers aren't very good, but you know yourself, because you're such a good handicapper, that the horse doesn't really fit or would need to run the race of its life to win. How much influence does that have on you when you're going to run one?
If I'm going to be live or not?
Yeah.
Well, I want to be live every time, so it's not real exciting when you look at the book and you're the form and you know you don't have much chance to win. I mean, I'm optimistic and hope for the best, but you know, if you're in a 9-horse field and you know you're going off 25-1, you probably don't have the best chance of winning the race, but normally you just try to get a good race and hope that the race you want to be in the following time comes back, and, you know, just try to get something good out of the race, or if it's a young horse, let the horse learn something, and hopefully you can live to fight another day.
Do you ever scratch one because you go, this horse has no chance, I'm not running him?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't want to put – you know, I love my horses, so I don't want to put them in a spot where I know they don't have any chance to be successful. I mean, I don't think it's fair to the people who work for me, fair to the horse, or fair to the owners. I mean, if you don't have any chance, you know, which that doesn't normally happen, but every once in a while you're like, wow, where'd all these horses come from? But it's probably, there are a lot of them are probably coming because whatever race they wanted to go in at their track didn't go, so they need to run somewhere, and they're looking in the book the same way I am, and all of a sudden there's 3 Kentucky horses in an allowance race. So, but it doesn't happen a ton, you know, maybe once or twice a year, but I don't want to put my horse in a spot where he has no chance of being successful.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
Do you think now that the trainer stats and all that are printed in the form that it discourages people from running?
Like trainers?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably a lot of trainers care what their percentages are, you know. Like, I want to win horse races, but, you know, I want to do as best as I possibly can, but my percentage, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to run where you can't win, and, you know, it affects your percentage, but it, you know, still ultimately the percentage doesn't mean anything to the actual horse, you know, and that's what I'm hired to do, is train horses, not worry about my win percentage. So I don't really get super enticed into it, because I know sometimes, you know, you got to put 2 horses in a race and, you know, that's a guaranteed loss with one of them, you know, so I don't really get super into the percentage, but I'm sure some people scratch because they can't win. I see a lot of people who are, you know, 25%ers, when they're going to be 10-1, they scratch. So, but I don't normally scratch, you know, because I'm going to be 10-1. I just, you know, I don't think it helps the game, though, having the win percentages in the racing form, but that's how it is. It's a lot of people are sending horses to people just based on their win percentage. So I'm sure people who are trying to get more clients don't want to lose races.
All right. Well, we've got to take a break right now. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Hang tight, Shane. We'll be back with you shortly.
The Fasig Tipton November Sale. The world's premier breeding stock event annually posts the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. In 2015, broodmares averaged 3 times more than the nearest competitor, and racing and broodmare prospects averaged 5 times more, with weanlings selling for as high as $600,000. The Fasig Tipton November Sale, November 7th in Lexington, Kentucky. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 33 Grade 1 winners, including 7 Breeders' Cup winners, 5 Horses of the Year, and a Kentucky Derby winner. Millridge raised foals of 2014 include Oscar Performance and Grade 3 Sanford winner Bitumen. Millridge is offering an outstanding group of yearlings at this year's Keeneland September sale, with 24 yearlings in books 1 and 2, over 90% of those raised or foaled on the farm. Millridge welcomes you to inspect these exciting racing prospects in which you can dream of participating on the biggest stage.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld, and I want to remind you that if you've missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. Also, remember this Saturday, September 17th, use your favorite ADW provider to watch and wager on the Grade 1 Rico Woodbine Mile live from Woodbine Racetrack in Toronto, Canada. This year's 35th running features the queen of the American turf, Teppan, and last year's victor, Mondialiste, recent winner of the Grade 1 Arlington Million. The Rico Woodbine Mile carries a $1 million purse and is a win and you're in for the Breeders' Cup Mile. Wagering at Woodbine includes large guaranteed pools and a 20-cent bet minimum on all Triactor, Superfecta, Pick 3, and Pick 4 pools. First post Saturday is 1 p.m. Eastern Time. That's the Rico Woodbine Mile at Woodbine. Back to our conversation with trainer Shane Myers. Shane, at the beginning of the show, we talked about you being a son of Tommy Myers, the famous Ohio jockey, and later on when you started training, he actually rode some races for you. How cool was that to have your dad ride races for you?
Sometimes it wasn't so cool, but
I was gonna ask, that's my follow-up question, but answer the first one first.
it was cool, and you know, now that he doesn't ride anymore, it was awesome, you know, like to look back on it, you know, not realizing, you know, in that exact moment, you know, exactly what was going on. Cause most of the time the son is riding the horse for the dad. And, you know, in our instance, it was the opposite way. So it was really cool. And, you know, to look back on all of the, you know, times, you know, in the paddock and stuff was cool, but you know, at those exact moments, you know, it wasn't really that cool when, you know, you wanted to give instructions and he, you know, didn't necessarily listen. And I mean, it wasn't the best thing at that time, you know, cause when you're mad at the end of the race, you know, you don't really want to yell at your dad. So, you know, it's not very respectful.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. But did that cause any uncomfortable dinner conversations?
Well, racing's always kind of been one of those things that it just isn't discussed at the dinner table. So it never really did, but it was really cool, you know, to look back on it now. You know, it was at the beginning of when I first started and stuff, but it was cool. So, but it was never, I mean, you know, you just kind of like after the race, you know, sometimes you want to strangle the jockey, but you know, you just say whatever and then you go back to the barn and take care of the horse and everything's cool 5 minutes after the race. But I do get very irritated, not necessarily with just him, but when the guys just don't listen or they ride a stupid race. But, you know, you just, I don't say anything, go back to the barn, and then after 5 minutes, I'm fine. So,
yeah, you learn to slough it off. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes you get irritated. I definitely know how that goes, but it's got to be a little bit tougher when it is your dad. Your dad won a couple races on my wife Gretchen's horse, Lil Red, and I always thought that was like the coolest thing. Got to see, you know, you give your dad a leg up, and he's out there wearing my silks, and you guys win a race together. I always thought that was super cool.
Yeah, well, that was the first horse that anyone ever sent me, and you know, obviously that was a lot to do with you and our friendship that we've had over the years, and I greatly appreciate it. And you know, I know my dad appreciated it and was very happy to win for you guys too, so thank you.
No, you're quite welcome. We met through a mutual friend, Carlo Campanella, who's on Vegas Experts. He's a professional handicapper, does a lot of football stuff and horse racing as well. You know, he's a very good handicapper. Did you learn much from Carlo about handicapping?
At that time, Jude, when I was gambling, you know, I was working, you know, different jobs, you know, whatever they happened to be, working the lottery booth or whatever. They could have just given me my paycheck in the form of a credit voucher for the track, and I'd have been a lot happier because I wouldn't have had to cash it. But I was betting anything at that point. So, you know, when you're young and stupid, you know, I think Carlo taught me a lot of stuff about not betting stupid, you know. And it wasn't really until I probably lost every dollar I made working until I was in my early 20s. But then, you know, with the invention of the Pick Four, when that came out, it finally made it, you know, where I realized you needed to make scores in order to make money gambling, because betting win just doesn't add up. So, but that was also the days when they didn't have these 50-cent tickets, and, you know, you had to play a dollar ticket, and an 8-to-1 or a 9-to-1 wasn't as easy to have as it is today, you know, so. Yeah.
No, it makes a huge difference. I've noticed that myself, that because the increments are 50 cents, and you heard me on the live read from Woodbine, they're 20 cents. So a lot of people can have a winning ticket. And in the old days when it was a dollar maximum, it was tougher because you had to think about whether you were going to put that extra horse in that could, you know, supply it with an $8,000 or $10,000 winning Pick Four. But now the prices on it seem to have dropped considerably. Actually, I think the prices on the Pick Three have gone up. What do you think about that?
They've went up in the payoffs, or the
in the payoffs, yeah. Because a lot of people are playing Pick Fours, and so sometimes the Pick Threes get ignored. They're for like a.
I don't know. I don't really get involved that much anymore gambling, so I don't pay attention to it that much. But I know that. For me, I would much rather the increment be a dollar, because it makes a horse a lot, you know, an 8-to-1 or a 12-to-1, you know, it makes it actually really boost the payoff, because, you know, not everyone has it. And, you know, I think a lot of people start handicapping sloppy because the tickets are cheaper, you know, like it's, instead of really getting down and spending 45 minutes on a race of who you think can really win, you know, you're like, oh, this horse can win, this horse can win. And if you have a single, you know, it's cost you not that much money to add two more horses a race. So I think a lot of people handicap sloppy. I noticed I was doing it, and that was one of the reasons why I quit really getting involved.
Well, you've made your name in the claiming game, and do you think your handicapping skills are part of the reason why?
I don't know. I think just probably the most thing that helps the horses that I have is, you know, I try to make them be as best as they can possibly be. You know, I try to get them healthy so they're 100%. And, you know, sometimes you get lucky and just get a good horse at the right time, or you try something, or they fall into certain things that you're doing and they start doing well. But I definitely think having good knowledge, you know, to help claim horses, definitely. It does never hurt you, because I know a lot of, you know, the bigger trainers have people scouting horses for them. And, you know, I could never have someone like scout a horse for me, you know, unless it was a sharp owner, you know, someone who understood the game. But I don't understand how trainers like could have someone else scouting horses for them to claim. So, but, you know, obviously they're, when you have a lot more horses, it's a little bit different. So,
yeah. Well, what philosophies do you use when you're looking for claims? You know, what you like, surface switches or distance, or you look for trainers making a mistake with a horse that you think you could do something different. How does that work?
I just look at the form and see, you know, obviously you always want to look at the trainer is the first thing I look at, because there are certain people you can't even consider taking off of, you know, the super trainers that are training 34% and you can't even consider thinking you can move one of them up. But, you know, you ideally look for someone who, you know, maybe is a little not doing as well, or things aren't going right for them, and a horse maybe that slipped through the cracks or something, and hopefully you can get lucky and turn it around. But I like to look for, you know, horses that have speed going short and they've never really been routed, and, you know, hope maybe their breeding suggests that they could go long and they can get an easy lead and they might keep going. That's probably been the thing that I always look for first and foremost if I'm really actively looking for a horse. You know, most of the other times, if one just stumbles across me, you know, it's whatever. You just hope and get, you hope you get lucky and you get something that you can work.
A lot of times it's serendipitous. The horses do fall into your lap. Sometimes you'll just be sitting there reading the form and you go, wow, look at this horse. I could do something with that. Or look at this pedigree. Maybe I could put the horse on the turf or something. And that's quite fortunate when that happens.
Oh, yeah. That's sometimes you're not even looking, and that's when you get lucky. Or sometimes you're waiting for a horse. And, you know, I hate to claim horses that are dropping down. I mean, I just think you're playing with fire, you know, 9 times out of 10, because most people aren't going to give something away unless, you know the horse is sound and it's, you know, dropping down because it just hasn't been competitive. But most of the time I don't even look at droppers, and, you know, horses that are coming out of those super trainers barns, obviously, you know, you just have no chance to improve them. So I don't even consider those either. And, you know, ideally you can find one that fits all the right criteria and you can line everything up and hopefully you get lucky and, you know, you're the only person in for it. Or if you can get lucky and win the shake, and then hopefully you just get something that you can work with and improve just a little bit, and hopefully you can win a couple races with it.
If you just joined us, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Shane Myers on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Who do you consider the best claim you ever made?
Either a horse named Storm and Larry or Kilo were the two best horses I probably ever claimed.
Tell us about them.
Storm and Larry was a horse I was always looking at because he was an Ohio bred and he was always running at Keeneland, but always for more money. And I always wanted to get him, but they always were running him for a little more than I thought he was worth. So he was in one night at Mountaineer for $5,000. So my mom said to go down and claim him. So we did. And I just wanted, you know, to get a decent little horse that could win a few races and hopefully win a 1X, because he was Ohio bred and he still had the 1X. And we claimed him for $5,000. And in the last 3 years, I think he's made like $250,000, which is great. And he's just a nice horse. I didn't just got lucky at him. I mean, the guy who had him before me did a great job. I don't know, you know, why he turned around. I think it just, you know, the attention to detail sometimes help when you have less horses. And the other horse was one of the horses that I just, he had speed and I always thought he would go long. And when I got him, he just, I think, was one of the horses that slipped through the cracks. that the guy had before me was a cheap horse for that guy. And for me, he was my best, my newest horse. So, you know, I did everything I could to try to get him 100% and healthy and everything. And he just flourished when I first got him. And he won, I think, like 3 out of his first 4. And I claimed him for 4,000. And he ran 2nd and 3rd that year in some stakes. So he was a nice horse for us, too.
Yeah, that's cool. Is there any horse that you ever claimed that you would want back because something clicked in your head after you had him? Like, man, I wish I could have that horse back because I would do this or that.
Not really. I mean, there's been a few that I have claimed back just because I like them. But most of the ones that I've had that I've lost through the claim box, I've never really thought that I did, you know, anything wrong. I definitely have made mistakes with horses I've had on my own and wished I could have went back and changed this or thought I did a bad job training the horse. You know, one day I was driving and I thought about something and I should have done this and I didn't, and I don't have the horse anymore or whatever. And I, you know, those type, but never one that's been claimed from me. Because obviously, you know, everyone makes mistakes in this game. So, and the one main problem of the whole thing that all the trainers have to deal with, and it's just that the horses won't talk to us. So,
yeah, it's a game of trial and error, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, and it's way easier to make a mistake than it is to always do the right thing. So, you just hope you can learn something from every horse that comes through your barn, and you know, use that knowledge moving forward and become better.
What about young horses? Do you hit the sales very much? Would you like to hit more of them?
We've purchased 3 horses in the 2013 Phasic Tipton sale, and I had never started with a horse before, you know, so I had always had claimers, and I found out, you know, from the first time I ever had it, is I was frustrated when they were 2, you know, because you don't get to run, you know, and I'm used to like wanting to enter and run, and you know, that you got problems where you can't run and this, that, and the other. And when those horses, as they got older, you know, they're 4 now, 2 of them ended up doing pretty good, and the other one had an injury, and she ran once, but she was no good. Her knee was messed up too much. And so then last year we bought 7 more horses, and they're all 2 now, and I've only gotten 2 of them to run so far. So I like the young horses way more. It's just, it's taking me a while to, you know, I'm learning, you know, like with only having 3, you don't really get to learn a whole lot as opposed to having 20, you know. So I learned that, and now I'm learning different things. But the one thing I've always done with the young horses is I never rush them. You know, I just take my time with them. And if they don't make it to the races, they don't make it, which is frustrating for me, you know. But you got to do the right thing by the horse in order to have a good horse when it's 5 years old, too. So,
yeah, I think that's a philosophy that a lot of trainers nowadays don't have. I mean, they go from meet to meet instead of thinking about the long-term career of a horse. And I think it's always a good goal to hope that you're training that horse when he or she is 5 years old.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's the, you know, you see a lot of these guys who get 20, 32-year-olds, they just keep going and going and going. And some of the better trainers, it's like, man, I just wish I could have the ones that they didn't stop on, you know, when they needed a break. So, you know, when you have that many horses, you know, and I'm sure they had horses before that had issues and they just kept going and going, and then they got lucky and a horse did good. So they think that's probably the way to go. I mean, I don't have that luxury at this time, and I don't think I'd ever want to do that to the horses anyway. You know, if they're not ready, you can't rush them and force them into works and then into races and stuff. So,
yeah, a lot of times you have to try to educate the owners alongside the horse when you're dealing with young horses, because they have that urge to run, and they've put money up for a horse. They want to get to the races, obviously, but as a trainer, you've got to kind of temper that enthusiasm a little bit.
Yeah, most of the people that I have as owners, they don't really say anything. And if they start saying too much, you know, and they want to force me into doing something that's not right, I just tell them that they need to find someone else to do it, because I'm not going to do something to a horse that I don't think is fair to the horse, you know. And but there, most of the owners I have are very good. They leave the judgment up to me, and they know that I'm going to do right for the horse. So,
are you,
but I do understand what you're saying with some of them, because some of those ones just don't work with me. The ones who think they know everything, but they never even see their horse except the day it's in the race. So,
yeah, it's always been a puzzlement to me how somebody sitting behind a desk in New Jersey knew what I was doing with a horse in California, you know, every day of my life.
And they're successful business people. That's the thing that doesn't get me.
Yeah.
They run a business that makes tons of money, that they're there every single day, but then realize, hey, I haven't seen one thing that's went on with this horse for 40 days, but I'm going to tell them that we need to do this or do that. And it's like, well, you wouldn't do the same thing with your business. Just let me do what I need to do, you know?
Right.
But
so always tough. The people are much tougher than the horses. That's for sure.
Tougher.
When you're not at the racetrack, what do you like to do?
Well, as I'm sure most of the people who probably come on the show say, you know, you don't get a whole lot of free time when you're training horses. So, you know, obviously traveling would be something I'd love to do. You know, if I could get a week out of the year, that'd be awesome, you know, just to go to a different place. And I do normally try to take a few days when just there's only one place, or over the winter where I'll go down to Gulfstream or Keeneland for a few days, just to, you know, see how everything is run, you know, at the real races, and talk to the few people I know. But as far as an everyday basis, it's always nice to go out and get a good meal, if you can find a good restaurant, which that's probably one of the best things you can do as a trainer, is just get out of the barn and just soak in a normal few hours of the day.
Try to be a regular person for a little while.
Yeah.
what about sports? Do you follow any teams or any of that?
I love the Cavs. I always liked the, you know, because I've been in Cleveland my whole life, and I love them. And I don't mess with the Browns. You know, they never do anything, and I don't think they ever will. And I always watch the Cavs, though. I pretty much watch every game they play. Even if it means I go to bed, if they're in Portland and I get done at 1:30 and I got to wake up the next day at 4:30. I mean, that's the one thing I do, but I'll take a nap, you know, the days when they're playing on the West Coast. But I love the Cavs and the other sports. You know, with football, you don't really get much chance to watch it because, you know, they play on Saturday and Sunday, and you know, you, for me, I kind of lose interest if I don't know all the players or what's going on in something. So I don't really get that interested in the football anymore. I used to when I'd gamble on it. I knew everything, but not anymore.
Yeah, you don't do daily fantasy sports or any of that?
I used to do it, and I just was a bad owner as a team. Like, I just told the other guys in the league, I was like, man, I'm not even, like, really – a person that you have to worry about. I'm a guarantee to beat, because I just don't have the time to know the players and, you know, watch everything. You know, I mean, you could see if you won or lost that week, but in fantasy football, but I got rid of my team a few years ago. It just wasn't fair to the other teams in it. I didn't want them to have a guaranteed win every week. So,
well, speaking of guaranteed wins, the Lakers haven't been doing very well lately, and that's been a boon to my sleep, because every year when I first moved to Kentucky and they were in the playoffs, I walked around like a zombie because I was watching all those late games all the time. So I can totally relate to the Cavalier thing. That's kind of wild. What about the Tribe? Are they going to win this year?
I don't know. My dad watches them, but I don't. I mean, I think in baseball, it's it's not always necessarily the best team wins because, you know, it's such a short series in the playoffs. You know, they only play, best of seven or whatever, best of five. I don't even know. I don't really follow baseball that much anymore. But you can get lucky and you're a good pitcher, get beat one day, and all of a sudden you're down 2-0 in a best of five. You know, you could get the better team could lose.
Yeah, that's the thing about baseball. I've got a friend from Cleveland, Lee Weber, and he keeps saying the Tribe's going to win the World Series this year. So him and my wife are at odds over that because she's a longtime Cubs fan, as you know. But it'll be interesting. What do you got on the horizon? Are you going to come to Keeneland? Are you going to bring some horses? You're kind of like my secret weapon at Keeneland. You turn one loose, even if they don't necessarily win. Sometimes they're in the money at big prices and key some good payoffs.
I don't know. When they took away the poly track out of there, it, you know, was probably better for the horses, but it depleted, you know, the horses from Ohio can't really compete there. And the ones from Presque Isle, they did well there, but without the poly, you know, they don't really run. So I don't know. I might come down there and go out to dinner with you and maybe claim a horse, but I don't think I have anything that can compete there right now. Well, and then the other problem is even if you do have something that can, if you try to win, you know, you drop a horse that you've been running for 12, 5, or 15 in for 10, you know you're going to lose the horse, and then you got to run against Ramsey dropping one down from 25 into 10 that if the horse is okay, you probably can't beat it, you know. So you go down there and lose one of your best horses, and you don't even win the race. So, and you can't replace that horse necessarily that easy. So it's very, very tough to win there. And, you know, I want to win if I'm going to come there. So I've never won there yet, Jude. I think I've run like maybe 20 and I had a few seconds and thirds, but I've never won. So I kind of don't want to really go over there again if I don't think I can win.
Yeah, it's like running a horse in the Derby. You don't want to run one just to run in the Derby. You want to have a chance. And Keeneland is tough. And I'll tell you, Mr. Ramsey's very, very tough to beat. You're right about that. Do you have anything you might run in the Claiming Crown down at Gulfstream?
I only have one horse that could fit in a race like that. And I don't. He would need the turf. And I don't know what the bottom tag that they're running on the turf was. Is like for the Claiming Crown. I don't know if it's 25,000 or what, but I would need it to be as low as possible. So,
yeah, well, that's
what's the bottom on the turf? Like 16?
Yeah, I think so. I think the turf races are a little bit higher. I know they have some races for 5,000, starter 5,000, but I think the turf races are a little higher. Well, maybe that's one you could claim at Keeneland. We'll go out to dinner. We'll have a good time.
Yeah, well, we always have a good time. You know that.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time here, and it's been great visiting with you today. That hour just flew by. Thanks to Shane Myers for taking the time out of his typically busy day to spend some time here. And Shane and all of our guests on Trainer Talk receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Shane will get that out to you. A special thank you to my producer, Lee Delapina, for keeping us in line and on schedule. I want to remind everyone to tune in to the Equine Forum, the show that launched this network, this and every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. on Sirius XM 93 and streaming live on our website, horseracingradio.net. This is Jude Feld from our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.